From the Iris.
Nice to meet you.
I'm Bede from the Super Network. Hey, nice to meet you, DJ. Nice to meet you.
Michael from Just for Fun magazine.
Right, is there somebody here with toys? Is there something? Is that like
sort of?
Like, is it kids?
No, I'm Carl from the Outer Haven. We do pop culture toy reviews and
video game
reviews, stuff like that.
Nice to meet you. I have a terrible sailor's mouth, so. I just want to make sure that...
Well, you're in the right country.
Yeah, I know.
Swearing here is pretty much a second language.
Yeah, I know.
I'm happy to kind of jump in first. So, Man in the High Castle.
Yeah.
We're up to second season now.
Mm-hmm.
For you, what sort of challenges, I guess, came up with that particular show as an actor?
Well, to start, initially, when you get a part on a television show, there's a bunch of auditions. And I haven't auditioned in 12 years. I don't do it anymore, not because I think I'm awesome, because I'm terrible at it. So my manager puts me in a position where when things come across his desk, we just refuse them to force an offer. And on that job, it was a mistake, because all these actors had gone through like 7 auditions and mix and match and all these tests, and I get there and don't realize how big the scope of the world is, and I panicked. It's probably the biggest budget thing I've done in maybe 10 years, and I arrived the first day, and there's like 300 people in period costumes in downtown Seattle, where we shoot the show in Vancouver, and all this Nazi iconography on the side of buildings. I'm like, what the fuck have I signed on to? And then I started realizing, like, the producer of the show is Philip K. Dick's daughter, the guy who wrote the book. And it's a lot of responsibility. So I start panicking. And my first scene, it was pretty rough. There was a lot of things that, like, German words that I hadn't thought of. So I wasn't prepared. But she came over to me, Issa Dick, Philip K. Dick's daughter, like, and said they celebrated when I was cast. And her father would have loved it, and it eased me, and I was able to do it. And I really love being on the show. It's complicated because the first year, like the tone of it, and just sort of the world that we live in the show, it's really depressing, and it gets you. But then you get used to anything. And I remember the first time that Hitler worked, and our names, not our character names, not our actual names, are on a trailer door. So I'm like smoking a cigarette, walking to makeup. I'm like, oh, Hitler's here today. Took a picture of it and post. And so we're so used to that sort of like iconography and the idea of the world that we live in. It's our job. Last year at San Diego Comic-Con, the show did this pop-up experience where we had to all go and tour around. It's like virtual. We had all our sets there. It was a virtual reality thing where you could walk around our world. And so they're like, go there in your off time and take some photos. So we were on our way to the IMDb yacht, and we were drunk out of our fucking minds. And because this is what you do at Comic-Con, you have like 12 hours of press in the day, and then at night you get wasted. And it's like, you know, also it's like a reunion. You see people like, I see Jerry Jensen from Supernatural, people that I don't see all the time, people that I've known for, you know, the entirety of my career, including, what's his name? Who's the little short guy in Austin Powers?
Ben Troy.
No, the taller short guy.
Seth Green.
Oh, Seth Green.
He hates me for some reason. And he's always hated me my whole career. I think because he's best friends with Brecken Meyer, and Brecken somehow thought that I stole his thunder in Road Trip, which is my first film. I was like such an innocent kid. So happy to be in Hollywood. I couldn't believe it. And so this guy's always hated me. So the year before, I'll get back to my story in a minute, but the year before, there's a party at Comic-Con in San Diego, the Entertainment Weekly party. It's like how we close it out. So every person who's invited, basically every celebrity, goes to this. So I woke up to Seth Green, and I am hammered. And he's hammered too, and he was like, I don't know why we've always, you know, had a problem. And I'm like, he's this tall, and I'm like, I don't know why we've always had a problem. and I was like, we should be friends. I'm like, oh, cool. And I'm so drunk, I don't know why I did it. I pet his head, and I kissed the top of it, and he's immediately furious. And my buddy was like, you just fucking touched a little person on the top of the head. They hate that. Now he hates me again. Last year, we're going to the IMDb yacht, and we stumble past our experience, and we had the security guard let us in. So we're taking photos because they told us to tweet things. We take photos in front of me and the cast and a couple of my local buddies, take photos on the set. And then we took one photo in Hitler's office and we posted it on Twitter. And it's up for like 2 days. At like 4 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, I get a call from Amazon Publicity in New York City. Take that photo down. It was a photo of us in front of a photo of Hitler. Because it was his office. And he had a picture of himself above his desk. It did not even occur to me. So you get used to, the point of the story is you get used to anything. It's just the world that we live in now. But it's a great show. We start our third season in 2 weeks.
Cool.
Yeah.
With a career spanning nearly 20 years in TV and film, if you had to pick two memorable roles, what would they be?
Oh, wow. I mean, that's hard. Road Trip was my first movie. It changed my life. I literally went from working in a law firm to 6 months later being on The Tonight Show. It was that fast. It was amazing. I felt at that point in my life that everything that I ever wished for as a little boy was coming true. And it was a feeling that I couldn't believe. Probably next would be... Hustle and Flow, which was a movie that I did instead of doing a sequel to this sort of comedy horror film, which I won't mention, that they were doing the second one, and I got offered $2 million to suck my own dick in it. And I've never been offered that before or since. And my manager was like, you're not the kind of guy that could suck his own dick and walk away from it. Like, comedians can do that. I mean, there's certain things that Jack Black could do that I couldn't do. Every actor has a sort of a range of things they can get away with. And they're like, if you blow yourself, you're not going to work again. You're going to be the guy that did that, and you'll take your $2 million, and you'll go home if you want to cash out. And I was like, I don't. So instead, I took a tiny paycheck to do this little independent film, and it was pure joy. And when we won Sundance, I was in the audience, and I cried. I was so happy for our director and our cast, and it was a hard shoot, and we really believed in it. And, you know, they had that movie in development for like 4 years, and it finally came together for them. And that's the one thing I like about being entertainment, is that by the time a part gets to you, it's 2 to 4 years of someone's life, and their dreams are coming true. Mm-hmm. And so it feels, being on a set is magic for me, and it's where I feel like I'm most at home, because it's a bunch of carnival folk who've left their lives and ran away to try to do something. All the people that they know are back home living their own lives. And it's a really sort of isolated experience, and you become very close to those people. And I've just now gotten to the point where it doesn't wreck me when I leave a job. It's taken 17, probably 15 years, for me to be able to say this is a great experience, and our friendships are valid, but they're probably only in this experience. But whenever I see you, I'm gonna love you to death, but I'm not gonna mourn the loss of you, because I gotta go on and now meet 150 other people on a new production.
So. With Road Trip being like your breakout role, mm-hmm. What was it like when you took on your first major lead role with the new guy?
You know, what happened during that time was I got paid very little for Road Trip. I was living in kind of a bubble, because after the movie, I still lived in Nashville when I did it. I was being flown into LA for press and flown all over. Back then, it doesn't happen now, back then when you had a movie out, you would do a massive publicity tour, like press junkets in New York and LA, and then you would take the movie to Europe and then go all around Europe. So that was my life for a while.
Yep.
And I didn't have any money, and I was kind of sweating that, but it felt so good. And I get home and had like $2,000 in the bank, and I was like, I don't know what to do. And whenever you do a junket, for example, this question always comes up to actors, so what's next? And a lot of times there's nothing next. And you're waiting until somebody thinks of you to give you a part. And I was in like all these magazines and on television and all this publicity I had done, but it took a while for Hollywood to be, oh yeah, come this way and do this other project. So the next thing I did, I think, was this movie about a bomb on an airplane that Barry Sonnenfeld, the guy directed the Men in Black movies. And,
oh yeah, I've seen that
one. But it was about a bomb on an airplane that was supposed to be released September 20th, 2001. Mm. September 11th happened. So the movie was quietly released, but it was like, you know, Tim Allen, Rene Russo, Stanley Tucci, Zooey Deschanel's like third movie.
Yep.
Ben Foster, like all these actors, Jason Lee, so Sofia Vergara's first English language movie. It was this giant production, and it went nowhere. But the point of that story is Barry Sonnenfeld really wanted me to do the part, and they were only going to pay scale for it. And my manager was like, he's probably going to have to go home because I had nothing. And that's what happens a lot in your, most of the time. It takes a while for your income to match your lifestyle. Like, I lived in a shitty one-bedroom apartment in Santa Monica. It was like $800 a month, and I couldn't afford it. And that's the other thing, is that the publicity takes away from your ability to be able to do another job right away. And he, my manager, was like, he needs this amount of money probably just to keep going, and Barry paid it to me. So he saved, I owe him basically my career. So while I was doing that, the new guy came in as an offer, and the script was rough, and so I asked for script approval, and then I wanted to cast the best friend, the girl, and Zoe Deschanel. I was working with her, and I was like, I want her to come and do it with me. So it was like I had a friend who came with me, so it was like it didn't feel weird or scary.
Yeah.
Also, I think just naively, there's a lot to be said for being too stupid to know that you could fail. It seemed easy when I first started. People were just handing me roles. Like, really, I think I did in my first 3 years like 12 movies. So it seemed really easy, and I didn't know it wasn't easy until like 2009, which was like 9 years later. And I was like, this is really hard to keep going and sustain yourself, and you have to make really wise choices, and people judge you. And the other thing that I had to deal with was the media. Because I don't look like a typical Hollywood actor, the media came for me. They would praise my performances. Like, I've honestly never had a bad performance review in my career. But they would pat me on the back and then stab me by taking a jab at my appearance. I think the New York Times wrote an article once, like, human bookmark DJ Qualls shines. The Memphis commercial appeal called me an Auschwitz survivor. Like, all this kind of terrible negative shit. When I first started, and it broke my heart, and I read all that stuff and I would cry, because my dreams are coming true, but I never expected this. I never thought that people would come for me when I'm doing my job and I'm doing the best that I can, and doing better than that. I think I'm doing well, and I'm surviving in an industry that is stacked against me, and that stopped probably maybe 5 years ago. You become part of the zeitgeist after a while. And people are just like, you know, you're one of us. He's our, you know, goofy looking cousin John. And he comes to the family reunion, and nobody thinks about it. And that's been really great. Just sort of, that said, Hollywood has never made me feel like I don't belong. It's always the sort of the outside of it, like the people that write about it.
Yep.
Want to take shots, and everybody thinks they're Howard Stern. It was like the beginning of that. You know, when Howard Stern was like shock jock and saying terrible stuff about people to their faces. And so the media for a while was doing that, and it was the birth of TMZ, and that was an interesting period because you would get jobs from going out. So like I was hanging out with Lindsay Lohan and all these, if you had famous friends, it made you look famous because Hollywood's a giant high school. So you would get jobs from doing that kind of stuff until people stopped showing up for work. I think I was in New York doing something, and then I get a call that the bar that, LA nightlife was really organized. Monday nights was Joseph's. Tuesday nights was this bar, you know. And I think our Thursday night place was a bar at the Roosevelt, and it got raided by the cops because suddenly somebody was like, how are the Olsen twins and Lindsay Lohan, they're all 19 years old, staggering out of this bar drunk? And it changed. Everything changed in an instant. All of a sudden, it looked bad to be seen going out. And TMZ was really... was the beginning of I think actors really becoming aware of the power of their personal lives and publicity. And I saw that, and I made the choice right then. I was like, I'm only going to trade on my work. I'm not going to trade on, I never talk about my friends. I never talk about who I'm dating. I never talk about any of that stuff because it's not for sale. But all that's a learning curve. There's no mentoring in this business. There's no way, how do you know? What's interesting about being an actor now for 17 years is that when I started, it was like everybody had, it was your class of people, like the, you know, Jessica Alba and Paul Walker and Brittany Murphy and all these people who were in my class, and to see who's died or whose careers have stalled or who's become super famous or who's gone crazy. That's really interesting to look around me and see what has happened to all of us. And it's, I mean, honestly, it's made me withdraw from being close with actors. I need some sort of sanity. My two best friends, one's a doctor, and one is a commercial weed farmer.
Just sort of playing into your answers about sort of being typecast. Did you ever feel in your early days that you were sort of, you were the goofy cousin stereotype, or you were the nerdish one, and that's all you were going to get? Or
Well, I remember having, you know who Amy Smart is?
Yep.
She was the Blondie Road Trip. I remember, and you know, she's best friends with Ollie Larder. You know who she is? She's, okay, I'm not trying to name drop, I'm trying to give you context and stories. It's probably a name drop, I talk about Jay-Z or Oprah or somebody. Great people. Anyway, so I was having lunch with Amy Smart, like maybe 3 years into my career, and I was kind of bummed out. She's like, what's wrong with you? I was like, I'm typecast. Like, I was working all the time and doing well financially, and I was having a good time, but I, you know, everybody thinks when they first start that they're gonna win an Oscar for best, you know, dramatic actor or something. It's what you want. And, you know, we were like in our mid-20s, and I was, you know, had all those ideas still, and I mean, who knows what's gonna happen. I don't say that I don't have them anymore, but I'm more happy with where I am now. I'm content. But I was talking to Amy, and I said, I'm typecast. And she was like, you're cast. Do you know how hard it is for me to get this job? And she was working well before I became an actor, and I looked at her, and I thought she was a famous person and a star. And to hear that it's hard for us as a group of people to sustain ourselves and keep going. And if you find something that you're good at and Hollywood will cast you in those roles, then it's your responsibility to do an independent film to get a little further away from that, or do a guest spot on a TV show and get a little further away from that. Because people will let you try to do other things, but they probably won't let you do it in a big budget studio film. Because they only want to do, I mean, look at the movies that are produced there. Like, the title tells you the couple's retreat. It's the whole movie. You've seen the whole movie if you've seen the poster. And that's what Hollywood is. And if you want to be an artist or an actor, then you find something that maybe won't pay you what you're used to, or the conditions will be a little hard, and you try. Early in my career also, I remember seeing an interview with Julia Roberts, and the interviewer said, you haven't done a movie in 2 years. And she said, well, show me a movie I should have been in 2 years. And even as a young performer, I thought, there was an independent film out there from a kid just out of film school that's probably had an awesome script that you would have been able to finance just by your name. So you can't say that. There was probably not a $20 million paycheck out there for you that you should have been in. But it's our responsibility as performers to do that, and also to give back. My closest friend who's in the business is a writer-director, and how I met him was that he wrote a short and used his mother's life insurance movie to finance it. And a casting director, who's a really big deal in LA, who I casually knew, she cast me in Breaking Bad, sent me a letter saying that he wrote the script for you, he's using his mother's life insurance and pays for it. If you don't do this, you're an asshole, because it's your job to give back, because you've been given so much. And she's right. So I look at it like that. I don't feel typecast anymore. And even when I was typecast, what a privileged place to be in. So it takes all these years to, if you have any sort of ability to see yourself from here and not just be mired down in your own bullshit, to look back and go, this is awesome. It's like how every young person looks back, an old person looks back at pictures of them and is like, look at how hot I used to be. But you never know when you're there. And so I pride myself now on being, like, I'm in my late 30s now, of being like, all the time, like, this is fucking dope. Like, I'm Australian, I didn't pay to come here. That is cool. I don't know how we start talking about this.
Hey, we're enthralled listening, man. Keep talking all day.
I'll open up in a few minutes. So just... Yeah, cool. So one of the things I wanted to touch on, you were sort of talking about, I guess, unique productions. And to me, Fargo has been one of those TV series that has just, every season, just it gets
so
crazier
good.
And crazier and better and better. One of the things that I wanted to know, particularly with your character, he's so briefly in the show, but yet has such a, like, impact. And he was listed as the character title as Golem.
Yeah.
Like, was that done on purpose? Like, did Noah Hawley specifically want your character to be representative of that mythological creature, or is
Golem's like, you know, I think a Jewish mythological creature who's like sort of formed from clay, like a shapeshifter.
Yeah.
You know, I did that. I was supposed to come to Australia for the last, I think, for Perth and Adelaide. And I had to cancel 2 days before because I had gotten offered this part on Fargo, and I had to go. When Noah Howley wants you to do something, you do it. And I'm a big fan of the show. And I loved it because it was like a silent film. The character has like four lines in both episodes. And I love that. I once got so high on marijuana, I thought I was Mary Pickford reincarnated, you know, the silent film star, which is the story I'll tell you at the time. But it made me giggle because it was like a silent film role. And when I had that freak out, and I can't smoke weed anymore because of that, actually. When I had that freak out, it made me start watching a lot of silent films. I was like, and they had to say everything with their eyes. I mean, they overacted a bit. This is what you did back in the day. But it was great. It was the hardest job I ever had. The conditions were really terrible. We're running down hills, working with a deaf guy at night in the woods. And his translator is oddly also deaf. And we have a British director who loves to do this. So, darling, what you're going to do is going to turn here and you're going to run up this hill to Russell, who's deaf. And so that was, you know, every day. And really dangerous stuff. But it was amazing. And that's the beautiful thing about being able to do what I do and not being a leading man, is that I get to inhabit all these different shows. I get, you know, I've been on Lost and Breaking Bad. And so all in Big Bang Theory, you get to have moments, these pop culture moments, for the entirety of your career if you're lucky. And it's dope.
Okay. One more.
You played Garth on the TV series Supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find working on that show, and are you a fan of that sort of genre?
You know, I'd never seen the show before. They sent me the script, and I read it, and I didn't understand it. So they sent me a couple episodes, I called my manager, and I was like, "Is this like? Are they underwear models? Like, what? They're running after demons, like, or monsters? Like, what's?" It was like, "You know, they're good-looking guys, and they kill demons. That's sort of the whole show." And it was like, you know, it was like I think the seventh season, and I was like, I'm not doing this. I'm not going to be on a show where I'm not just less better looking than the two leads, but like staggeringly so. I'm not going to do that. Why would I do that? And it was like, and then Jared contacted me and was like, you know, they wrote this for you. You should come on. Just do one episode. You'll see. It's a crazy fandom. You'll love it. I did one episode, and like after it aired, I could not walk down the street without being called Garth. It's like, you know, in soap operas when people like come up to the like actors in malls and like cuss them out for cheating on Penelope. It's like that kind of stuff. Like whenever I get a new part, they're like, "Garth got a movie," or "I saw Garth in Law and Order," or that kind of stuff. And it was jarring at first, but now it's sweet because unlike the Twilight movies and that sort of cult fandom, these fans will follow you to your next job. They want to see you in other stuff. They always want you back on Supernatural, but I just read a tweet the other day. It's like, if we can't have you on Supernatural, I love seeing you on this, like on Z Nation and Man in the High Castle. It makes me happy. And that's amazing.
Loyal fans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some of them are scary, though. I had a security incident at Rhode Island Con this year. This crazy lady shows up and gives me her father's antique 18-karat gold pocket watch. And I'm like, I can't accept this. And so she's like, if you don't take it, I'm going to throw it in the garbage. So, like, I took it, and then the next day she brings me, like, a 20-page pack of, like, a letter that she wrote to me, and, like, gift certificates to a restaurant in Boston, and, like, a coffee card, and, like, all this random stuff, and, like, a pages from a personal journal, and I'm like, I'm worried, because, you know, and so then she kept standing at my table, and the thing about when you do these things, people come, and they travel to see you is that you owe them at least 60 seconds of undivided attention where you're, you know, talking to them and asking them things. And I never want to be somebody's bad experience, but she wouldn't leave and she would come into my line when I was trying to talk to kids.
Yeah.
And so finally she had to be removed. So she shows up the third day, the last day, and demands the watch back. And I'm like, it's in the bottom of my bag in my room. Here's my rookie, go get it. So I sent somebody up and gave it to her. And then 2 weeks ago, I get a package to my home address, an apology package from her. She found my home address.
Oh,
she knows where I live.
That's scary.
It's so scary. So that's fandom gone wrong, but that's so rare. But it can't happen because people do, when they love something so much and you are a part of it, you can lose the line.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Like I get asked supernatural questions all the time about things I don't know. And when I was talking to, I think it was Jared about it, he was like, don't lie, they know more than we do. Because they remember things that we don't remember. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
So are you guys going to, is anybody going to print this or whatever, like soon, before the...
Probably not tonight.
Probably in the next few days.
Before
so.
The,
okay.
Because I only have like five swords, and I'm told.
They were good.